Chapter 22. Playwrights and musicians, and the traveling archaeologists who hawk their antiques about from one court to another. Here you may assist at interminable disputes as to the relative merits of Tasso and Ariosto, or listen to a learned dissertation on the verse engraved on a carnelian stone. But as to the questions now agitating the world, they are held of less account than a problem in counterpoint, or the construction of a doubtful line in Ovid. As long as truth goes naked, she can scarce hope to be received in good company, and her appearance would probably cause as much confusion among the bishops literati as in the councils of the Holy Office. The old analogy likening the human mind to an imperfect mirror, which modifies the images it reflects, occurred more than once to Odo during the hunchback's lively delineation. It was impossible not to remember that the speaker owed his education to the charity of the order he denounced, and this fact suggested to Odo that the other lights and shadows in the picture might be disposed with more art than accuracy. Still, they doubtless embodied a negative truth, and Odo thought it probable that such intellectual diversion as he could hope for must be sought in the bishop's circle. It was 2 days later that he first beheld that prelate, heading the ducal pilgrimage to the shrine of the Mountain Virgin. The day had opened with a confused flight of chimes from every bell tower in Pianura, as though a migratory flock of notes had settled for a moment on the roofs and steeples of the city. The ducal party set forth early from the palace, but the streets were already spanned with arches and garlands of foliage, tapestries, and religious paintings decked the facades of the wealthier houses, and at every street shrine a cluster of candle flames hovered like yellow butterflies above the freshly gathered flowers. The windows were packed with spectators, and the crowds who intended to accompany the pilgrimage were already gathering, with their painted and gilt candles, from every corner of the town. Each church and monastery door poured forth its priests or friars to swell the line, and the various lay confraternities, issuing in their distinctive dress from their hodges or assembly rooms, formed a link between the secular and religious divisions of the procession. The marketplace was strewn with sand and sweet herbs, and here, on the doorsteps of the cathedral, between the featureless porphyry lions, the bishop waited with his red-robed chapter, and the deacons carrying the painted banners of the diocese. Seen thus, with the cloth of gold dalmatic above his pontifical tunic, the mitre surmounting his clear-cut impassive face, and the crozier held aloft in his jeweled gloves, he might have stood for a chryselephantine divinity in the porch of some pagan temple. Odo, riding beside the duke's litter, had leisure to note not only the diverse features of the procession, but their varying effect on the spectators. It was plain that, as Tresker had said, the pilgrimage was popular with the people. That imaginative sensuousness which has perpetually renewed the Latin Church, by giving form and color to her dogmatic abstractions, by transforming every successive phase of her belief into something to be seen and handled, found an irresistible outlet in a ceremony that seemed to combine with its devotional intent a secret element of expiation. The little prince was dimly felt to be paying for the prodigality of his fathers, to be in some way a link of suffering between the tongue-tied misery of the fields and the insolent splendor of the court, and a vague faith in the vicarious efficacy of his devotion drew the crowd into momentary sympathy with its rulers. Yet this was but an underlying element in the instinctive delight of the people in the outward forms of their religion. Odo's late experiences had wakened him to the influences acting on that obscure substratum of human life that still seemed, to most men of his rank, of no more account than the brick lining of their marble-coated palaces. As he watched the mounting excitement of the throng, and pictured to himself the lives suddenly lit up by this pledge of unseen promises, he wondered that the enemies of the Church should ascribe her predominance to any cause but the natural needs of the heart. The people lived in unlit hovels, for there was a tax on mental as well as on material windows. But here was a light that could pierce the narrowest crevice and scatter the darkness with a single ray. Odo noted with equal interest the impression produced by the various members of the court and the church dignitaries. The duke's litter was coldly received, but a pitying murmur widened about the gilt chair in which Prince Ferrand was seated at his governor's side, and the approach of Tresker, mounted on a fine horse and dressed with his usual sober elegance, woke a shout that made him for a moment the central figure of the procession. The bishop was none too warmly welcomed, but when Crescent Eye appeared, white-haired and erect among the parish priests, the crowd swayed toward him like grasses in the suction of a current, and one of the duke's gentlemen, seeing Odo's surprise, said with a smile, "Colin, no one does more good in Pianura than our learned librarian." A different and still more striking welcome awaited the duchess, who presently appeared on her favorite white hackney, surrounded by the members of her household. Her reluctance to take part in the pilgrimage had been overcome by the exhilaration of showing herself to the public, and as she rode along in her gold-embroidered habit and plumed hat, she was just such an image of radiant and indulgent sovereignty as turns enforced submission into a romantic allegiance. Her flushing cheek and kindled eye showed the reaction of the effect she produced, and if her subjects forgot her debts, her violences and follies, she was perhaps momentarily transformed into the being their enthusiasm created. She was at any rate keenly alive to the admiration she excited, and eager to enhance it by those showy impulses of benevolence that catch the public eye, as when, at the city gates, she stopped her horse to intervene in behalf of a soldier who had been put under arrest for some slight infraction of duty, and then rode on enveloped in the passionate shouting of the crowd. The shrine at which the young prince was to pay his devotion stood just beyond the city, on the summit of one of the low knolls which pass for hills in the level landscape of Pianura. The white column church with its classical dome and portico had been erected as a thank offering after the plague of 1630, and the nave was lined with life-sized votive figures of dukes and duchesses clad in the actual wigs and robes that addressed their transient grandeur. As the procession wound into the church, to the ringing of bells and the chanting of the choir, Odo was struck by the spectacle of that line of witnesses, watching in glassy-eyed irony the pomp and display to which their moldering robes and tarnished insignia seemed to fix so brief a term. Once or twice already he had felt the shows of human power as no more than vanishing reflections on the tide of being. And now, as he knelt near the shrine, with its central glitter of jewels, and its nimbus of wavering lights, and listened to the reiterated ancient wail, "Ater inviolata, ora pro nobis, Virgo veneranda, ora pro nobis, speculum justitii, ora pro nobis," it seemed to him as though the bounds of life and death were merged, and the sumptuous group of which he formed a part already dusted over with oblivion. 2.13. Spite of the Mountain Madonna's much vaunted powers, the first effect of the pilgrimage was to provoke a serious indisposition in the Duke. Exhausted by fasting and emotion, he withdrew to his apartments, and for several days denied himself to all but Hale Jenstern, who was suspected by some of suffering his patient's disorder to run its course with a view to proving the futility of such remedies. This break in his intercourse with his kinsman left Odo free to take the measure of his new surroundings. The company most naturally engaging him was that which surrounded the Duchess, but he soon wearied of the trivial diversions it offered. It had ever been necessary to him that his pleasures should touch the imagination as well as the senses, and with such refinement of enjoyment the gallants of Pianura were unacquainted. Odo indeed perceived with a touch of amusement that, in a society where Don Serafino set the pace, he must needs lag behind his own lackey. Cantapresto had, in fact, been hailed by the bishop's nephew with a cordiality that proclaimed them old associates in folly, and the soprano's manner seemed to declare that, if ever he had held the candle for Don Serafino, he did not grudge the grease that might have dropped on his cassock. He was soon prime favorite and court buffoon in the Duchess's circle, organizing pleasure parties, composing scenarios for Her Highness's private theater, and producing at court any comedian or juggler the report of whose ability reached him from the marketplace. Indefatigable in the contriving of such diversions, he soon virtually passed out of Odo's service into that of Her Highness. A circumstance which the young man the less regretted as it left him freer to cultivate the acquaintance of Gamba and his friends without exposing them to Cantapresto's espionage. Odo had felt himself specially drawn toward the abate Crescenti, and the afternoon after their first meeting he had repaired to the librarian's dwelling. Crescenti was the priest of an ancient parish lying near the fortress, and his tiny house was wedged in an angle of the city walls, like a bird's nest in the mouth of a disused cannon. A long flight of steps led up to his study, which on the farther side opened level with a vine-shaded patch of herbs and damask roses in the projection of a ruined bastion. This interior, the home of studious peace, was as cheerful and well-ordered as its inmate's mind. And Odo, seated under the vine pergola in the late summer light, and tasting the abate's Valpolicella, while he turned over the warped pages of old codes and chronicles, felt the stealing charm of a sequestered life. He had learned from Gamba that Crescenti was a faithful parish priest as well as an assiduous scholar, but he saw that the librarian's beneficence took that purely personal form which may coexist with a serene acceptance of the general evils underlying particular hardships. His charities were performed in the old unquestioning spirit of the Roman distribution of corn. And doubtless the good man who carries his loaf of bread and his word of hope into his neighbor's hovel reaps a more tangible return than the lonely thinker who schemes to undermine the strongholds of injustice. Still, there was a perplexing contrast between the superficiality of Crescenti's moral judgments and the breadth and penetration of his historic conceptions. Odo was too inexperienced to reflect that a man's sense of the urgency of improvement lies mainly in the line of his talent. As the merchant is persuaded that the roads most in need of mending are those on which his business makes him travel, Odo himself was already conscious of living in a many-windowed house, with outlooks diverse enough to justify more than one view of the universe. But he had no conception of that concentration of purpose that may make the mind's flight to its goal as direct and unvarying as the course of a homing bird. The talk turning on Gamba, Crescenti spoke of the help which the hunchback gave him in his work among the poor. His early hardships, said he, have given him an insight into character that my happier circumstances have denied me. And he has more than once been the means of reclaiming some wretch that I despaired of. Unhappily, his parts and learning are beyond his station, and will not let him rest in the performance of his duties. His mind, I often tell him, is like one of those in parlors hung with elaborate maps of the three heretical cities, whereas the only topography with which the virtuous traveler need be acquainted is that of the heavenly city to which all our journeyings should tend. The soundness of his heart reassures me as to this distemper of the reason, but others are less familiar with his good qualities and I tremble for the risks to which his rashness may expose him. The librarian went on to say that Gamba had a pretty poetical gift which he was suspected of employing in the composition of anonymous satires on the court, the government, and the church. At that period every Italian town was as full of lampoons as a marsh of mosquitoes, and it was as difficult in the one case as the other for the sufferer to detect the specific cause of his sting. The moment in Italy was a strange one. The tide of reform had been turned back by the very act devised to hasten it. The suppression of the Society of Jesus. The shout of liberation that rose over the downfall of the order had sunk to a guarded whisper. The dark legend already forming around Ganganelli's death, the hint of that secret liquor distilled for the order's use in a certain convent of Perugia, hung like a menace on the political horizon, and the disbanded society seemed to have tightened its hold on the public conscience as a dying man's clutch closes on his victorious enemy. So profoundly had the Jesuits impressed the world with the sense of their mysterious power, that they were felt to be like one of those animal organisms which, when torn apart, carry on a separate existence in every fragment. Ganganelli's bull had provided against their exerting any political influence, or controlling opinion as confessors, or as public educators. But they were known to be everywhere in Italy, either hidden in other orders, or acting as lay agents of foreign powers, as tutors in private families, or simply as secular priests. Even the confiscation of their wealth did not seem to diminish the popular sense of their strength. Perhaps because that strength had never been completely explained, even by their immense temporal advantages, it was felt to be latent in themselves, and somehow capable of withstanding every kind of external assault. They had moreover benefited by the reaction which always follows on the breaking up of any great organization. Their detractors were already beginning to forget their faults, and remember their merits. The people had been taught to hate the society as the possessor of wealth, and privileges which should have been theirs. But when the society fell, its possessions were absorbed by the other powers, and in many cases the people suffered from abuses and maladministration which they had not known under their Jesuit landlords. The aristocracy had always been in sympathy with the order, and in many states the Jesuits had been banished simply as a measure of political expediency, a sop to the restless masses. In these cases the latent power of the order was concealed rather than diminished by the pretense of a more liberal government, and everywhere, in one form or another, the unseen influence was felt to be on the watch for those who dared to triumph over it too soon. Such conditions fostered the growth of social satire. Constructive ambition was forced back into its old disguises, and ridicule of individual weaknesses replaced the general attack on beliefs and institutions. Satirical poems in manuscript passed from hand to hand in coffee houses, casinos and drawing rooms, and every conspicuous incident in social or political life was borne on a biting quatrain to the confines of the state. The Duke's gift of Boscofolto to the Countess Belvedere stirred up a swarm of epigrams, and the most malignant among them, Crescent I averred, were openly ascribed to Gamba. A few more imprudences, he added, must cost him his post, and if Your Excellency has any influence with him, I would urge its being used to restrain him from such excesses. Odo, on taking his leave of the librarian, ran across Gamba at the first street corner, and they had not proceeded a dozen yards together when the eye of the Duke's kinsman fell on a snatch of doggerel scrawled in chalk on an adjacent wall. Newer, the quatrain ran, O virtuous wife or maid, our ruler's fondness for the shade, lest first he woo thee to the leafy glade, and then into the deeper wood persuade. This crude play on the Belvedere's former title, and the one as he had recently acquired was signed Arlo Gamba. Odo glanced curiously at the hunchback, who met the look with a composed smile. My enemies don't do me justice, said he. I could do better than that if I tried, and he effaced the words with a sweep of his shabby sleeve. Other lampoons of the same quality were continually cropping upon the walls of Pianura, and the ducal police were kept as busy rubbing them out as a band of weeders digging docks out of a garden. The Duchess's debts, the Duke's devotions, the Belvedere's extortions, Hale Jenstern's mummery, and the political rivalry between Tresker and the Dominican were sauce to the citizens' daily bread. But there was nothing in these popular satires to suggest the hunchback's trenchant irony. It was in the bishop's palace that Odo read the first lampoon in which he recognized his friend's touch. In this society of polished dilettanti, such documents were valued rather for their literary merits than for their political significance, and the pungent lines in which the Duke's panaceas were hit off the Belvedere figuring among them as a Lenten diet, a dinner of herbs, and a wonder-working bone, caused a flutter of professional envy in the episcopal circle. The bishop received company every evening, and Odo soon found that, as Gamba had said, it was the best company in Pianura. His lordship lived in great state in the Gothic palace adjoining the cathedral. The gloomy vaulted rooms of the original structure had been abandoned to the small fry of the episcopal retinue. In the chambers around the courtyard, his lordship drove a thriving trade in wines from his vineyards, while his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.